Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Stuttering is a condition that affects the rhythm and flow of speech for nearly 3 million people in the U.S. It's not caused by anxiety or a lack of intelligence. It's a neurological difference that often begins in childhood and can last a lifetime. Yet for many, stuttering carries a heavy weight: social stigma, misunderstanding, and pressure to speak normally. But that narrative is changing. More people who stutter and those who support them are challenging outdated views and embracing a more accepting, informed approach to communication. Joining us today is Ms. Louise Height, a licensed and certified speech-language pathologist practicing in Alaska since 2001. Ms. Height brings decades of experience across schools, clinics, and home health, and a personal connection to this topic through her own experience of stuttering. She serves on the board of the Alaska Speech Language and Hearing Association and chairs the Rural Networking Special Interest Group. Also joining us is Dr. J. Scott Yaris, a professor at Michigan State University and a nationally recognized expert on stuttering. He's been funded by the NIH and NSF to research how stuttering impacts quality of life and how therapy can improve it. He's also a longtime advocate and member of the National Stuttering Association Hall of Fame. Ms. Height and Dr. Yaris, welcome to Line One.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yep, thanks so much. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you. Okay, welcome again. I've been looking forward to this conversation. This is not something that I have a lot of experience in, so it was very interesting to do the research on stuttering and to have you both here today on International Stuttering Awareness Day, right? October 22nd. Yes. Yay. And so you've been very, very busy all month. So before we begin, I would like to just get to know you both better. And I want to have you share a bit about your journey and what drew you into the work that you do. Ms. Height, why don't we start with you?
Well, I come from a family that has a history of stuttering. I did not know that myself until I was very much a grown-up. But two of my mother's brothers were stutterers. As a child, I was, as a child, I was taught to recite poetry, and my mom had ambitions of theater. And when I was about 4 or 5, I started to refuse because it was so hard. My parents weren't terribly accepting of differences of any sort. So I spent a long time kind of wondering how come I wasn't as quick to talk as most of the people that I knew. Often I would just retreat into silence if I was under pressure. And after I became a grown-up and trained in a completely different field, I found myself alone with a lot of time to explore things. And one of the things I started to explore was stuttering. And I learned a whole lot. It was the early years of the internet, and I got involved in several discussion lists and eventually made the decision in middle age to change fields and retrain as a speech pathologist because I liked what I learned about. I knew that there was more, and I didn't like the way people were treating people who stuttered. These were still the days when most of the treatment was operant conditioning of one sort or another. The kid has a disfluent day, they get a jelly bean kind of thing. And you know, I didn't like dog training for something like that that I knew from the inside was going to happen anyway. So I went back to school and retrained as a speech pathologist and wrote a research paper that is still being written, to be honest with you. Dr. Yaris is helping me with it. I think he may regret having offered me that offer, but Exploring the implications of what I knew from my own internal experience was a tendency to dissociate or kind of blank out at the moment that the words stopped coming.
Very interesting. Thank you for sharing that. That's a very personal experience. Dr. Yaris, tell us about how you came into this field, and then maybe you can make a comment on Ms. Height's experience.
Absolutely. My background is a little different because I fell into the field truly by luck, sheer luck. My undergraduate studies were in linguistics and psychology because I love the study of language and I love the study of people. I'm a little afraid of people in person, but I love the study of people. And so when I was in college, I was looking for something where I could take those fields and do research. From the time I was knee high, I knew I wanted to do research. I just didn't know what the word meant, and I didn't know what in. I didn't care. I just knew I wanted to do research. And so I got lucky because I asked one of my major professors one day if he knew of a field where I could take linguistics and psychology and use it in a way to actually help people. And interestingly, he said to me, no, I really can't think of anything, because they were very pure science fields, the way I was brought up and where I was studying at the time. But it just so happened that his wife was a speech language pathologist. And so he said, why don't you go talk to my wife? She may be able to help you. And I discovered pretty quickly that this is what I wanted to do. When I applied to graduate school, pardon me. I didn't have any background in the field at all, in the clinical aspects or anatomy and physiology or all those things that we do. And so one of the applications asked if there was a specific area of the field that I wanted to study, and I thought it would help me to get in if I listed something. Now, my grandfather stuttered, so I also come from a family with stuttering. My grandfather stuttered, my uncle stuttered. And so I wrote stuttering. I didn't know anything about it. We had never talked about it. It wasn't like I swore an oath to overcome this thing that had plagued my grandfather. It was nothing like that. I thought I wrote stuttering like that. And sure enough, after I got into graduate school and I went and I started studying stuttering, I met the best people in the world, just truly dedicated people, passionate people. And I found it fascinating because it sits at the intersection of so many different disciplines. And this directly relates to the experience that Lou was sharing about her own life. There's neurology involved, there's psychology involved, there's linguistics involved, there's speech control involved, there's social interaction involved. It's a field that is rich for further study. And indeed, society stigmatizes stuttering terribly. People who stutter are not treated well by their fellows. And so we need to improve that. That's part of what International Stuttering Awareness Day is all about. And that's what led me into my career. So it's exactly the type of experiences that we were just learning about that caused me to become passionate about this.
Well, we have similar passions. I am very passionate about languages and people as well. So, very interesting the route that things take people in different directions. Well, you brought up the psychology aspect, and then we heard from Ms. Hyde about her experience. And so, this is not just a speech difference, but also part of your identity as well. And how do you see the identity shaping how people experience and respond to stuttering?
Well, I'll take the first step on that one. It's not a very common disorder. I mean, we've got 3 million people in the country who stutter, and I think 1.5 of those million people are probably undercover. They have learned ways to avoid being caught. Just yesterday, I was working with a 10-year-old for the first time, and I asked her what she thought about it, and she said it's embarrassing. And it can be. In fact, among people who stutter, there is a kind of a common term that we refer to the look, because there is a certain look of what's going on that people who don't know what's going on will give you, and it can be very off-putting.
When you're
It
trying
can
to
make
speak, they're staring at you in a certain way.
it so it's the same way you would stare at. Oh gosh, what would be a good analogy? A three-legged dog
No. Okay.
Or some other thing that's far enough out of the usual experience that people don't have a template for dealing with it.
Right.
And it takes a lot of maturity and a lot of experience eventually to be able to stare it back down and to look at that person and say something like, "Well, it's a stuttery day today. You're going to have to put up with that."
Right.
But I'm old as dirt and I've finally achieved that point. My 10-year-old literally crawled under the table. She started squirming and she lay down on the chair and the chair next to her and put her head under the table. And I said, "Yeah, there's nothing to be worried about. We can do it." But you know how squirmy a kid can be when they don't really want to say, "I don't want to." So we spent a little while in this first session talking about the fact that it's really okay to stutter, especially in my room. And I shared a little bit about myself with her, only a little bit, teeny weeny little bit, because the point is within a therapy session that the point is the person who you're working with. But I wanted her to become or to think about becoming comfortable and talking about it. That's
Right.
really the first step. If it's not named, it can become a terrible monster.
Right. Well, let's start with the basics and tell us what is stuttering and how is it classified in terms of language or speech disorders? Dr.
Scott, I'm
Yar.
going to give that one to you.
You want me to go for that one? Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is an interesting question, actually, because the way we view stuttering is actively changing right now. Now, this is true for any scientific field. Ideally, there are always changes going on in how we understand and how we view differences that people might experience, disorders that people might experience. So stuttering has long been viewed in inappropriate ways, frankly, as a psychological problem. For a long time, that was you. I mean, Freud wrote about stuttering extensively. Stuttering has been viewed as a simply a tic, okay? But it's not that either. What we're learning is that there are many different aspects that come together in a person's brain that cause them to sometimes feel instances while they're talking when they can't get the word out. When we ask adults who stutter what this moment feels like, they tend to say they feel stuck. That's the word that is used most often. Or another phrase that's used a lot is, it feels like I've lost control of my speech. That phrase, loss of control, is something that seems to capture what many people experience. Another word that people tend to use is they're unable to move forward. We know today, thanks to ample research, that the ultimate root of these moments of feeling stuck comes from brain differences. Neuroimaging research has shown that the brains of people who stutter are different from the brains of people who don't stutter. Now, these aren't wholesale differences where you could look at a brain or an MRI of a brain and say, oh yeah, that brain, that has to be a stutterer's brain. It's not like that. These are subtle differences that we can determine when looking at groups of brains of people who stutter and groups of brains in comparison of people who don't stutter. But the differences are there, they're consistent, and they're robust. They have to do with the planning of language, what you want to say, and the production of speech, actually translating that into the movements for speaking. And there seems to be an occasional, because it's not all the time, an occasional breakdown in that transition from planning what you want to say to producing it. People who stutter know what they want to say in those moments when they're stuck. They know exactly what they want to say. It's not like non-stutterers might experience when we are thinking about a word or we go, how might I say? It's not like that. They know exactly what they want to say, but in that moment, they feel like they've lost control, they feel stuck. It's neurological, has to do with language, has to do with speech. Those differences in the brain, in language ability, and speech ability, they seem to come largely from genetic differences. It's a very complex genetic inheritance. And we can't identify it in all individuals, but most people who stutter seem to have a family history, like both of us do. There's somebody else in the family. Now, again, we can't always find it. There are some mysteries there and much more research to be done. But these underlying genetic differences lead to underlying neurological differences. And then that sense of being stuck can make it hard for people to say what they want to say, to communicate with others, to express themselves fully. Because, as Ms. Hyde said, it's scary. It can be embarrassing. It can be frustrating, certainly. And society doesn't react very well to that. Society wants people to talk like everyone else. Society wants people to get their words out, to hurry up, to just spit it out.
Well, especially and here in the U.S., right? We want everything very quickly.
Everything's got to be just right, exactly. And that puts a lot of pressure on people and sends a message that it's not okay to be different. Now, people who are different get that message all the time in all sorts of ways, right? People who stutter are not the only ones who experience stigma by any means, but there is a stigma surrounding stuttering that people tend to internalize. And that's why when we talk about the identity as a person who stutters, being able to come to terms with that and being able to say, yes, I'm different and it's okay, that's a tough thing to do. And there's sometimes when society seems to be making some progress at being more tolerant of differences, maybe even accepting of differences. And there are other times, I know this is not a political show, but there are other times when we seem to be moving backwards quite quickly on that ability to accept people's differences. People who stutter feel that stigma, and it affects themselves and how they feel about themselves.
Right. That word tolerance has always been something that kind of bugs me, you know.
It gets at me.
Tolerating you. Acceptance, yeah. I do really appreciate that we're all accepted and we should all be, you know, empowered, but accepted as people, right? Not tolerated.
More than tolerance, right?
Yes, more than tolerated.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, in the introduction, I said that this is not an issue. Stuttering's not an issue of or caused by anxiety. But my question is, when they're stuck on that word, does it get worse due to anxiety?
It can. And it gets even worse when somebody tries to help. Imagine having a conversation with autocorrect.
Oh, goodness. Yes.
Yes. Mm.
Yes.
In fact, on my I'm an amateur artist, and on my website, I posted a cartoon of somebody stuck on a word and her friend trying to help her with about 25 words that all started with the same letter. And she's thinking it's like talking to autocorrect. And the second panel is the helper friend trying to write a note on her telephone and dealing with autocorrect. You have to acknowledge the goodwill. Somebody wants to help. What I have learned to say in my old age is, don't help, I'll get through it.
Yes.
And usually by taking that step, I am able to get through it. But it may not always happen. And, you know, the kind of ACT, cognitive behavioral therapy stuff, light that I have learned to do for myself has also worked very well for students. Matter of fact, I'm about to enroll in an ACT course because I want to strengthen my skills in that area. Last year, I was working remotely with a young man whose pattern, he was just 13, and his pattern was to get stuck and he'd go before moving on to the next word. And I just had him start to count up the ums and become aware of what he was doing. And by the end of the year, I was able to dismiss him. His teacher said that it was not interfering with his classes anymore. We put him on a monitoring plan called a 504 plan in the school business to make sure that he got accommodations if he needed them. But he had failed traditional therapy since he was about six.
Wow.
And that's another thing that I'm really interested in is the amount of therapy failure. And the problem that, Since it is a matter of being hardwired, yes, you can partially train it away. But very often, if somebody is going to not stutter, they're going to just not talk. And people tend to internalize themselves as failures. I'll never be any good. And I don't like that. I don't want to see that happen to people. Again, that's why I started. I had a spectacular experience with this moment of blankness during a stuttering moment. I don't want to go into it here. That made me think that this was really something that I needed to know more about and might help. It turned out that I had a smallish sample that I did some research on. It turned out that two-thirds of the people that I asked had the same kind of experience, and most of them had thought they were the only one that had it, and they all had a different term for it. One called it the white out, one called it brain unplugging, one called it going to another planet. Everything goes fuzzy, flying, sitting up in a tree, watching yourself. And all the language began to point towards classic dissociation, which has become a kind of a deep interest of mine right now.
Is this an experience that happens when you're in the midst of a stutter? Is that when this
Yes.
whiteout happens? Interesting. It's interesting what
Yeah.
we can learn just by talking to other people, and you find these shared differences or experiences that you have. Ms. Height, you brought up something about an important concept that I think we should just really repeat about not helping, like helping as in finishing someone's sentence when they're talking. There was a recent episode of the television show Survivor, and there was a contestant that had a speech difference. His name was Mitch Gera. And the host of the show asked him, so Jeff Probst asked him, if what should we do when you're, stuck on a word or you're trying to get your thoughts out? Do you want us, what do you want us to do? And he said, what a thoughtful question. He was really touched by being asked that. And then he responded, have patience. Don't finish my sentence. Give me the opportunity to finish my thought myself. And that he didn't like people jumping in there. And, that's something we all want, patience, when we're trying to share our thoughts, right? Whether you stutter or not. Are there people, though, that do want you to jump in there, or is it feeling like autocorrect for everyone that they just want you just wait and let me finish?
There are people, especially people who are early in their journey, who still have not learned that it's okay. If somebody's going to take the burden, they will do it. And I do that myself. I hate to talk to people on the phone, especially if I have to complain about something. And I have a big, lovable teddy bear of a husband who is voluble and funny and we'll talk your ear off if you give him half a chance. And I just give him the phone and I say, you make the complaint.
I see. Well, I do want to come back to this, Ms. Height, and let you finish, but we have to take our first break, and then I want to hear the rest of that. But you are,
Okay.
yes, thank you. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion of stuttering and stigma, changing the conversation with Ms. Louise Height and Dr. Scott Yaris as Line One continues statewide.
Hi, I'm Avery Elfelt, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media, KHNS, where I work in Haines, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, on Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by Ms. Louise Height, a speech language pathologist based in Alaska who has worked across settings from schools to home health. Also with us is Dr. J. Scott Yaris, a professor at Michigan State University who studies the lived experience of people who stutter and develops tools to improve therapy outcomes. Today, we're exploring stuttering and stigma, changing the conversation. Well, Ms. Height, you'd mentioned that speech therapy may not fully, or people who perform speech therapy may not fully be trained to work with those who stutter. Can you tell me more about that?
It's a really difficult condition to deal with, because for a very, very long time, the speech therapy profession, and it partly, I think, trying to justify itself scientifically, really was deeply into the Skinnerian operant conditioning model. In fact, when I was in training in the 1990s, we were still being told to bring in a bag of jelly beans and reward each child that we were working with in training with a jelly bean for every good performance.
And that's the operant conditioning model?
That's the operant conditioning, or in a somewhat snarkier term, dog training.
I can see that. Yeah.
I have a couple. I'm an amateur dog trainer, and when I'm working dogs, I have a pocket full of little tiny dog biscuits.
Right.
But, you know, and for some things it works. For things where the child just has not yet learned to keep their tongue behind their teeth when they're saying an S or something like that, and they know they're going to get that jelly bean, they'll keep their tongue in. But with something that's hardwired like stuttering, it doesn't work. And what it creates is a sense of failure.
So the speech language pathology or therapy is really helping to form the word, not necessarily with stuttering. The issue isn't that they have an issue performing sounds or creating words. It's the difference neurologically of producing the word, or not necessarily how to produce, but the actual act of producing.
Getting from knowing the word, hearing the word in your head, knowing what you want to say, and then getting those impulses from the speech planning area to the motor planning area, and then getting them out. I mean, I've got an enormous vocabulary because one of the tricks that people who stutter develop is a great big internal dictionary of synonyms. And if you're trying to talk about your new car and the C is sticking, you can say new automobile or conveyance. Well, but that's got a C too. That won't work. And sometimes on a really bad day, you might go through 5 or 6 words before you get one that's going to make that jump from one side of the, from the planning side to the execution side. And sometimes what happens is that you have this moment of dissociation where people have been quoted as saying, it feels like I've flown out of my body. I'm sitting on the branch of a tree watching myself, and I can't get off the tree until I say the word. It's a really strange kind of thing. And, you know, if I were 20 years younger and rich enough to afford it, I probably would be exploring in a very methodical way how the treatment of dissociation in other conditions like PTSD and things like that have been shown to work would work with stutterers. And, you know, maybe before I die, I'll do it. Expect to live a while longer.
Yes.
There is a person who's doing some work on the micro traumas involved with stuttering, because somebody who stutters, especially somebody who stutters severely, goes through the smack in the face 150 times a day. Mm. And it builds up. It's difficult. There's this young lady named, well, I guess she's in her 40s now, but she's younger than I am, named Kaya Goldstein, who's really put a lot of work into understanding trauma and trauma-based therapies and how they work, or the trauma-informed therapies, and how they might work with people who stutter. It's really very interesting stuff.
Yes, it is. Well, Dr. Yaris, let me ask you about whether there are specific sounds that are more likely to lead to a stutter. As Ms. Height said, you could use a synonym. So instead of car, you're using automobile. Is that because that sound of the C sound may cause for some more of a stutter than others? Why is it that a synonym would work?
It's a terrific question. The first answer is we really don't know why switching to a synonym might help people in that moment. We do know that when people get into a habit of doing that, it's a very dangerous, slippery slope. Because what if you can't say automobile in that moment? What if you can't say vehicle in that moment? What if you can't say, you know, sedan in that moment? Well, then you just find that you're moving from word to word to word to word. And what people often end up finding is that they say a word just because the word will come out, not because it's really the word that they exactly meant. It's just it gets it out because there's such pressure to appear fluent. When I say appear fluent, I mean to have it look like your words are flowing without interruption. But that's certainly not the experience that people are having on the inside. On the inside, it's like the floor is lava, you know, or like don't step on a crack on the sidewalk. They are constantly scanning and looking ahead and trying not to let somebody else see what is perfectly natural and normal for them. When people who stutter, stutter, they're doing exactly the way their brain is supposed to speak. That's how their brain is. But they feel like they can't, and so they do these things. About certain sounds, this is a question that's been studied for nearly 100 years. Well, many things about stuttering have been studied for a very long time. There are literally Egyptian hieroglyphs for stuttering, okay? So people have been thinking about this for a while. But the field of speech-language pathology, or what we call today speech-language pathology, has been formalized in the U.S. for about 100 years. And this was one of the early questions. Are there some sounds that are harder than others? And the answer is no, not really. It's just that some people feel that certain sounds are harder for them, and it becomes a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. In that, when people think, you know, are thinking of, I want to talk about my new car, and they say, oh, I always have trouble on that k sound in car. Well, that thought in and of itself takes up a bit of their cognitive resources and thereby increases the difficulty that they're likely to have. Furthermore, the fear. And, oh, our brains are amazing at remembering all those times we got stuck. This is like that time I stuttered on car when I was six and everybody laughed at me. And boom, all of a sudden they're spiraling. They're in the tree. They're out of body. And you bet they're going to stutter on car. And that reinforces that. But there's nothing special about the k sound in car. For one person, it might be that sound. For another person, it might be another sound. I know people who have literally picked the names of their children thinking that they would be easy sounds to say. But as those sounds become emotionally imbued, then all of a sudden that new sound becomes challenging in and of itself. So it's insidious yes. in that way, but it has a lot to do with prior experience and that weight of history.
Well, Dr. Yaris, let me ask you about trauma-informed care. Ms. Hype brought this up. Is this that the trauma is this history of stuttering that has led to a trauma? And then if we use trauma-informed care and empowering, then we can, in turn, that's the therapy that would be needed? How does that come in?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. So the therapy history in stuttering has focused largely on the speech component, that moment of being stuck, and how do we get people past that? But the field lately has been undergoing a really important transition of focusing more on the lived experience of people who stutter. That moment is part of it, but it's only part of it. But what we learn as we do that is we have to take into account other aspects of life experience, like the negative emotional reactions, the negative cognitive reactions, the repeated difficulty that people experience, the fear that that leads to, the shame that that leads to. And one way of looking at this that members of the field are beginning to do research in is as a series of traumas that contribute to an overall difficulty in a person's ability to cope in their lives with their stuttering. And that does naturally lead to the question of whether using trauma-informed clinical practices could help to address those aspects of the life of a person who stutters. See, our overall goal as a speech-language pathologist is to improve quality of life for our clients, whether they have a problem with their speech sounds, or whether they've had a stroke, or they have difficulty with swallowing, whatever the issue is that's within our scope of practice, our goal is to improve quality of life. And we are discovering that we can help to improve people's quality of life even more by recognizing more fully the impact of societal stigma on their life, how that societal stigma becomes internalized as a self-stigma, and how that can be viewed through the lens of repeated small t traumas that lead to an overall difficulty in coping with the fact that they're different. And that's where trauma-informed care, as one of a number of approaches, can come in.
Well, you shared some really powerful information and really about education. So you're empowering the person that has stuttering, but also, like we're doing right now, in educating society, people who may or may not have had an experience with someone who stutter or may encounter this in the future, but for us to learn more about this so we can interact and really change that stigma, and also just really understanding that this is not a lack of intelligence, right, or something that they need help with. It's a difference in how they're speaking. So very important to continue to spread that awareness. One of the questions I did have about stuttering was, it seems that it does start in childhood. Is there an adult onset of language production differences?
Absolutely. So what we typically refer to as stuttering is one of a number of different issues that might affect the flow of speech. The kind that we're talking about today is often referred to as developmental stuttering, although that's not really a preferred term because developmental kind of makes it seem like it's probably going to go away. And in fact, statistically, it does. Many young children who start to stutter do indeed stop stuttering on their own, regardless of therapy. It's also known these days in DSM-5 as childhood onset fluency disorder. That's the official name for this condition. But there are other kinds of fluency issues that people can face that do have a later onset. Sometimes kids just start to stutter, not in the typical age range, like between 2.5 and 4. That's what's most common. In fact, the average is just before the third birthday. Sometimes kids start at 6 or 9 or 12 or even 15, and we don't know why. We don't know why. We call this late onset stuttering, and this one is a scientific mystery for us still. Like I said, this is an area that is just in need of much, much more research. But there is another kind. There are other kinds of stuttering-like conditions that have their onset in adulthood. For example, a person who has had a stroke can have as one of the byproducts of that stroke disrupted speech. It's not the same, in my opinion, as the stuttering that occurs in childhood onset fluency disorder, but it's disrupted speech, and it's called neurogenic stuttering. Neuro, the brain, genic, that's the start. So it happens after a stroke or a head trauma or some kind of injury like that. Another is called psychogenic stuttering, which could be the result of a psychological trauma. It's not common. When these things happen, stuttering is not, disrupted speech is not the only symptom that you see. These are byproducts of the underlying neurological issue. So these things can also happen, but they are much, much less common even than childhood onset fluency disorder, typical stuttering, even though that in and of itself is not all that common, 1% of the population. So yes, that can absolutely happen.
Wow. Well, we've received an email and with some more questions for you. We have an email from Elliot who is sharing a video, which we can share on our website. And it is about Scatman John.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes. Okay, so they're sharing this clip. We can share this later. But the question that they have is, how is it possible for someone who stutters to be able to perform for millions of people in a concert, or in the case of the both of you, how do you talk in front of large audiences where it could be very stressful for you, even if you don't have a stutter?
Fantastic. I'm glad that this person has brought up Scatman John. John Larkin was a beloved member of the stuttering community. Sadly, he passed some years ago now. Lou, I don't know if you knew him, but and in fact, his scat style of singing incorporated his stuttering. In terms of the other question, Lou, I'll invite you to answer, because let me say, I myself am not a person who stutters. I'm a speech therapist and a researcher, but I don't have the lived experience myself. So I want to defer to Lou on this question.
Well, I'm only going to answer for myself. As I mentioned early on, I was trained from wet diapers to stand up and recite. And I still remember poems from those days. I won't bore you with them. But performance was extremely highly valued in my family. And the ability to perform on cue was something that was highly valued. There is a different mindset to being in front of people and on stage. Stage training actually is very good for many people who stutter, because it's kind of like singing. You don't stutter when you sing either. And, well, you do. You can actually, like Scatman John.
Yep, you can.
But quite honestly, most people don't when they're singing. And when I have to go on stage, the first time I gave a scholarly paper, I had such a bad case of dissociation and stuttering and everything else that everything in front of me shrunk into something that would fit in the size of a quarter. But I called on high school drama training and family training to just pull up my socks and get through it. Enough of that will teach you how to do it. And honestly, when I'm preparing to do a talk or something like this, I kind of slip over into performance mode, and I wish I could explain what is different. If I could unscrew the top of my head and take a picture of what's going on in there, I probably would like to do it, but unfortunately that won't work.
Well, I say I've watched some videos of actors who had stutters, and one of the actors said that when they're performing their character doesn't have a stutter. So they didn't have a stutter. So they were putting them, especially those method actors, right? They're really embodying their character, and they were able to perform in that way. And then I'm thinking about singing, and when many people sing, they don't have accents. So, you know, I'm wondering if it may be a very similar pathway, in that your accent and your speech difference, we all kind of become one and the same when you're singing for some people. We do have to take another break, and then we'll get more into this. We've covered a lot of ground. So after the break, we will turn a little more to how society responds to stuttering. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media.
I'm Shelby Herbert, a reporter with the Alaska Desk. That's a joint reporting effort from Alaska Public Media and KUAC, where I work in Fairbanks, and other public radio stations in Anchorage, Haines, and the Aleutians. It allows us to connect you with the issues happening in communities all across the state. You can hear our stories during the morning news, Alaska News Nightly, or online at alaskapublic.org. The Alaska Desk is only possible with the support of grants and listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Our guests today are Ms. Louise Height, a speech-language pathologist and advocate based in Alaska, and Dr. J. Scott Yaris, a professor and researcher focused on improving quality of life for people who stutter. We've been discussing how stuttering is understood and the therapy that could be used to improve the quality of life for those who stutter. Okay, well, so we were talking a bit about empowering those who have speech differences and answering the questions about how they can perform. You know, I'm thinking about also the movie. What was the movie? The King's Speech, right? And he had a pretty significant stutter. I think this is fiction. Is it fiction? I'm not even sure.
No,
that's real.
Oh, yeah. It's real. Okay. Absolutely. Wow. So what, that's quite a world stage there to have to go and lead a country. And you have this difference where people may not, you know, respect that difference or may think that leadership wise, you may not have the things that are necessary to be a leader if you speak differently. So this person, though, on the in the movie, oh, and I think the director of that movie had a stutter himself. So, or not the director, the scriptwriter, right?
David Seidler. Yes.
Yes. David Seidler. Okay. David Seidler. Yes. So, but with this, he had some specific, you know, he did a lot of therapy to help him to speak differently. And I have seen people that do things like using the fingers to count. So are these very old therapy methods? And today we're switching to more of empowerment. Can you tell me about those differences?
They're not even old therapy methods. They're old habits that people fall into. Early on in days of yore, quite literally, people would be taught to do all kinds of strange things to try to get rid of the stutter. King George had to lie down on the floor. There was a belief for a very long time that smoking would cure it. And I wonder how many people that killed. The reaction of the public has always been much the same. It's so different that people wonder how somebody that does that can walk across the street and not fall down. But more seriously, Demosthenes put pebbles in his mouth to try to learn to speak. And Joe Biden put pebbles in his mouth as a teenager to try to learn to speak clearly. It does work for some people. It's such an individualized disorder that it's really hard to say across the board that there's something that works. I actually am working with a child who has a related condition, I think, called cluttering, but he's too young to diagnose. And one of the things that helps people who clutter is to have some kind of motor entrainment that they can depend on to slow them down and get all the syllables out. This little boy collapses words. A three-syllable word will wind up a one-syllable word with some extra sounds. And I've been having him count syllables on his fingers and slow down a bit. Now, that's not going to work forever. That's just beginning to teach him to be aware of his speech, and he will probably always have to be more aware of his speech than other people. But it doesn't necessarily work for stuttering. What happens in those instances? A stutterer can, in fact, do something like this and control their stutter, and that'll work for 6 weeks, and then it won't work anymore. So they'll go something like that to control their stutter,
like tapping.
And that'll work for 6 weeks, and it won't work anymore. So they're always chasing a butterfly that they're never going to catch. It's so much easier to just say, yeah, there it is. It happens.
Right.
Get on with it.
We have an email that came in to ask a question about learning foreign languages. Do you have a stutter, or does stuttering affect learning a foreign language or the production of such language?
For me, the better I got at the language, the more likely I was to stutter in it. I lived abroad for a while. I became a fluent speaker of Icelandic. I'm still fairly fluent. And at first, it was not a problem because I was concentrating so hard on creating speech at all. But when it got to the point that I could think in Icelandic and just chat, I began to notice that I was beginning to stutter in it. I suspect that that happens to other people. I know some people who adopt an accent. Bayard Rustin, the famous civil rights activist back in the 60s. Are you familiar with this, Scott? He had a pretty severe stutter, and he adopted an English accent so that he wouldn't stutter. And if you listen to him, I mean, he was, you know, thick as thieves with Martin Luther King and many other major civil rights leaders. And he always sounded like he might be from Jamaica or someplace like that. No, he was just trying to control a stutter.
That's very interesting. Wow, I did not know that. And also, yeah, it just brings up the fact, what if it's a nonverbal language? So what if you're communicating in a signed language, like American Sign Language? Would you adopt a stutter in this if it's nonverbal? So there's different production that's needed.
I don't think it's ever been researched. It's a really cool question. Doctoral dissertation right there.
In fact, it's been done. There is research on this. Not much, but there is research on stutter-like movements in signing, also in musical instrument playing, wind instrument playing. And indeed, it appears that there are analogs to stuttering in these other kinds of movements and these other kinds of complex planning. It's the same. It requires that transition from complex planning of what you want to do and actually doing it. So yeah, people can stutter and sign. For a long time, people were told not to try to teach a second language to a child for fear that that might lead to stuttering. Fortunately, today we know that this is not true, and parents should not fear teaching a second language to their child for fear of stuttering. The child may be disfluent, have interruptions in speech, but it does not elevate the risk of stuttering.
Thank you for sharing that. And that really just drives home the concept of it's not an auditory, or it's not a verbal issue if you can have the same differences when you're using your hands or using, it's more motor. Interesting.
It's not just a motor issue. That's
Yes.
It's more than that. Yeah.
Wow. Well, we have a caller that would like to share their experience. We have Todd from Anchorage, and we'd love to hear from you. So welcome to Line One, Todd.
Hey, guys. Very insightful program. Boy, I'm amazed. I just wanted to sort of mention something that happened to me, and it may have happened to more people than you realize, sort of, when you think about it. It's probably psychogenic stuttering, but when I was in college age, there was a period of a few months where when I would talk to somebody in any meaningful conversation, I would start to stutter. And the sensation was very strange to me. I've never, it's hard to explain for me. It's like you're slipping. You have no control. You just keep slipping and trying to get your footing. And it just was one of those things that it was intimidating and frustrating and, again, felt physically very odd to me. So, you know, this is the kind of thing that people should understand about stuttering, because you're right about sort of the derisive approach people have taken in the past. So thank you guys so much, and wanted to share that is all.
Yes, thank you for sharing that experience with us. Very interesting, because it sounds like it is that dissociative state that he's experiencing, in similar to what you were saying about being in the tree as a bird, but he's experiencing this slipping sensation. Is that similar?
It could be. I'd want to interview him a little more closely.
But, he needs to contact you. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I want to get one in. We are restarting the National Stuttering Association chapter in Alaska as a virtual chapter. And people who might be interested in it can contact me at info@heightslp.com. And I can get you on the mailing list for an invitation for the next Zoom meeting, which will be the second Thursday in December. I'd like people who are interested in stuttering to please dial in and get to know us. It's a virtual support group, and we decided to go virtual because Alaska's so big.
Yes. Well, that we are pretty much out of time, but there was an email that came in that wants to know about how they can get better services for students. So that could be a place where they can reach out to you so that you can have that really important discussion about helping students with stuttering. But thank you to you both. The time always goes so quickly. Thank you, Ms. Lou Height and Dr. J. Scott Yaris, for sharing your insights on stuttering and the communities surrounding those who have speech differences. Thanks to our audio engineer, Chris Hyde, and our producer, Rachel Cassandra. You can find more information on this and previous programs on our website at alaskapublic.org. Let us know your thoughts or suggestions by emailing us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.